Okay, so I'm going to change topics just a little bit and really focus on a process that some of my colleagues here in the room that I want to introduce to you here in a second, and I use to develop an instrument to assess stress, depression, and coping mechanisms among migrant seasonal farm workers living in the state of North Carolina. So I'd like to recognize, if it's okay, my two colleagues in the back, Dr. Sloan Burke and Robin Rager, who played an integral role in this process. And I'd also like to say that these two professionals are really the content experts regarding stress, depression, and coping in this population, whereas I'm really the instrument development individual with this project. So I'll go through the process that we did, a very comprehensive process, to work with this very, what I would call an invisible population, migrant seasonal farm workers. I do want to, before I begin, disclose that as health educators, we do not have any finances, nor do we have any personal financial relationships to disclose. So with that being said, we'll move on. Just to let you know that there are over 30 slides in this presentation, so I'm going to do my best to summarize the process as best I can, and then if you have any questions, of course, I'll be glad to answer that along with my colleagues in the back here. Just to give you a little bit of information about the population that I've worked with, and that Dr. Burke and Dr. Rager and I have worked with, migrant seasonal farm workers, of the 3 to 12 million migrant seasonal farm workers currently living in the United States, a majority are Latino, a majority are male, most are Spanish-speaking individuals. You'll see that a majority live below poverty level. Also, one thing that I'll point out is the environment in which they work and live. If you've had any experience with this population, you'll know that most live in isolated, unsanitary, overcrowded, and often very unsafe environments. So I would like to say that for what I call an invisible population, they really do contribute to a multi-billion dollar agricultural industry that I would dare to say that all of us benefit from. So really, in thinking about that, their mental health issues are very important to us as public health educators. Speaking in terms of stress and depression, as you know, there are direct and indirect effects of stress and depression that definitely affect daily functioning. And with that, one of the aspects of this study that I found very interesting was that we really focused on coping behaviors as well, or mechanisms that are used to cope with stress and depression among this population. So when I go through some of the literature, you'll see that there are some researchers out there looking at stress and depression as it relates to this population, but there's very limited information on coping behaviors, which was a big aspect of this study. And if you think about coping as it relates to stress and depression and the effects that that has on individuals' well-being, that really is very important for health education and promotion prevention strategies for this population. Just a very quick glance at mental health as it relates to migrant and seasonal farm workers. We did extensive literature search, and really, actually, Dr. Rager and Dr. Burke has worked with this population previously in the state of Texas. And from that research, along with others, we found that 1 in 4 migrant seasonal farm workers has had an episode of one or more mental health disorders such as stress, depression, or anxiety in their lifetime. And of the literature that we looked at in previous research that had been conducted asking the question about depressive symptoms, we found that approximately 30 to 40% of individuals who answered the question indicated having had a clinically significant levels of depressive symptoms within the past week, as that was how the item was asking, within the past week. So really, to think about why we did this study, not only do Drs. Burke and Rager have previous research interest in working with migrant seasonal farm workers, but really, in looking at the literature, we see that there's a lot of information on stress and depression as it relates to the general population, and in terms of instruments that have been validated in use in the general population. But when you look at this population, the subpopulation of migrant seasonal farm workers, there's very limited research on those types of conditions. And with that being said, there are also very few assessments that have been developed regarding stress and depression and coping, particularly looking at coping mechanisms, and validated for the use in this population. There is a really strong research group out of Wake Forest that has done some research in this area, really I believe we're some of the first that have really started to look at coping mechanisms as it relates to stress and depression. So the group out of Wake Forest indicated that in implications of studies that they have conducted, there's really a lack of studies that examine the efficacy of using survey-based research to collect data in this population. So with that, you know, with that as a foundation, my colleagues and I said, well, we really need to start looking more into this. Is survey-based data collection techniques the most appropriate, useful way to collect data with this population, very vulnerable population? So the purpose of this study was to develop a culturally sensitive instrument, and I'll give you the very detailed process as to how we did that with this population to assess stress, depression, and coping mechanisms. Also, this instrument was developed. It was pilot tested and used to gather pilot data on stress, depression, and coping behaviors among migrant seasonal farm workers living within three agricultural counties in eastern North Carolina. I do want to state that the sample, as you'll see, is small and it is limited to eastern North Carolina. However, for the purposes of instrument development, we feel this is very strong and something that we'll use in continued studies to get larger populations to further validate the instrument and the model that we've created. Because I don't have but 15 minutes, I'm going to really quickly go over the methods that we use, paying very close attention to the instrument design framework. It was a mixed methods approach. We utilized, actually Dr. Burke was the lead on the qualitative portion of this study. Three focus groups were conducted in counties in North Carolina. The data from those focus groups were back translated. We used in vivo to analyze the data. Grounded theory was used for emerging themes, and also the research team confirmed the themes for credibility and for convergence of the data. There were four major themes that are of importance to us as I talk about the instrument design framework, which is really the focus of this presentation. The four themes were, number one, physical stress as it related to their working conditions. Now, picture this. Dr. Burke and I out in rural eastern North Carolina in a tobacco barn doing some of these focus groups, out in the field with these individuals that work in those conditions every day. So physical stress, we could just see that in our observations of the working environment, what type of stress physically was put on these individuals. Secondly, mental stress as it related to family situations, work environment, documentation status, and the lack of resources. Thirdly, depression related to separation from family and the lack of resources. And lastly, use of positive and negative mechanisms for coping with stress and depression. The emerging themes from the qualitative data were very helpful in the instrument design framework as we use these as a foundation for the items that we were to compile for the instrument. Here is the instrument design framework that we used. This really is test development as it is outlined in the Standards for Educational and Psychological Testing combined with Dillman's four stages of pre-testing. So we took the standards and then combined them with Dillman's four stages to come up with what we use as our instrument design framework. So I'll go over each step as quickly as I can. Step one is really to identify the purpose of your instrument. And the standards indicate that before you start, obviously, putting together items to measure something, you have to know what you're measuring. What are those underlying constructs? And so we really relied on past research and theories of stress and depression and coping to come up with our constructs, which was stress in this population, depression, and coping behaviors, along with measures of locus of control. Dr. Rager, along with Dr. Eva Dole out of Texas, had conducted a study previously looking at locus of control measures, so we wanted to include this in the study that we were conducting in North Carolina. And locus of control, if you want to know what I'm talking about, is in terms of really control over the stressors or how much control the individual felt that they had over all the stressors that were identified or delineated in the study. Factors contributing to depression, overall health, and the coping behaviors obviously was really important to us in this study. Secondly, once we spent a lot of time, by the way, delineating what it was we wanted to measure with this instrument. So step one took a lot of time amongst the three researchers in the room here, and then we move forward to test specifications. And it's in this step where you really figure out what's the format of the items going to be. And it's in this step where you really need to consider issues of fairness and bias as it relates to the types of items that you're going to use an instrument. Thinking about cultural bias as well. So a lot of input and thought went into just the formatting. What types of questions do we want to see on this instrument? Thinking about the population that we were working with. So for the purposes of this instrument, we had a series of Likert scale questions along with open-ended items and the check all that apply questions. And those really pertain mostly to the coping behaviors. The coping behaviors are listed and the individuals would check which ones they would engage in most frequently. Once that was done, we moved on to the third step, which entails a pool of items. And basically, we drew from lots of researchers. We didn't reinvent the wheel. We went back to stress, depression, coping scales that were used in general population, and then used the Dillman's Taylor Design Method to modify any items as it related to the population that we were working with. So we contacted researchers that had developed instruments in this area. Dr. Rager and his colleague, Dr. Eva Dole, had also developed an instrument that we relied heavily on and had been tested in Texas. So we pulled from previous research, pulled these items together along with modifying items as we felt appropriate. Also, obviously, the emerging themes from the focus groups were very important in directing our decisions on what items should be included in the initial pool of items. So the final pool was 93 items. There was a lot of items to measure what we thought we were measuring in terms of types of stress, depression, and coping. The next step is then to submit the pool of items to Dillman's four stages of pretesting, which I know Dr. Klein spoke of earlier, so some of you might be very familiar with these steps. I'll go through them quickly. I have 5 minutes. Okay. And the first was to review by knowledgeable colleagues. So we convened a panel of experts, and those panelists include individuals that work with migrant seasonal farm workers, those that were survey developers that understood stress, depression, and coping in terms of content. We had them to review the pool of items. What we did was we asked them specifically, not just to review them and say, yeah, it looks good. We wanted specific data on each of the items. So we asked them to rank each of the item from a scale of 1 to 4 on importance. And if a majority of the reviewers, meaning 3 or more, indicated that an item was important to keep or extremely important to keep in the survey, then that was kept in the instrument. Also, because of redundancy, obviously we had a lot of items that we felt were measuring the constructs. We had a lot of redundancy. We asked them to say either keep it or omit it. If a majority said keep it, that item was kept in the instrument. This resulted in 17 items being reworded, 7 items were deleted, 9 items were added. Actually, a majority of the 9 added were demographic questions, and we had a 95-item instrument at this point, measuring what you can see here in terms of types of stress, depression, signs and symptoms of depression, and coping. Stage 2 was to conduct cognitive interviews, and I did this with 10 migrant seasonal farm workers. I'm sure you're familiar with that. If you're not, I can talk to you about it afterwards. Process, it was done by 3 bilingual translators that were trained to do this. These were gatekeepers in this community. That resulted in minor modifications to wording on 7 items. Then we subjected the 95 items, to a pilot test. We did this with 60 migrant seasonal farm workers, in which everything was obviously done in Spanish. We had bilingual translators, gatekeepers that were trained to do this, and we collected data on 60 migrant seasonal farm workers using the 95-item instrument. And stage 4, obviously, now that we have this data, we wanted to test it statistically to see if our measures held up to measuring the constructs we hope to measure. So with this, I did a principal components analysis with direct Oppelman rotation because of the correlation of the factors. And the purpose of this, obviously, was not to generalize findings to the general population of migrant seasonal farm workers, but yet to our sample, and just to see if the items are actually measuring the constructs that we wanted to measure: stress, depression, and coping. Very quickly, the results of the PCA indicated a five-factor model best fit our data. So in terms of factor loadings, really, I don't like that term, but structure coefficients indicated these are our 5 factors. Factor 1 was financial and family stress with 20 items. Factor 2, physical, work, and societal stress. Factor 3, stress due to lack of documentation and resources. Factor 4, depression. And 5 was the locus of control. All those items actually loaded onto what we then call a factor that we call locus of control. In terms of the subscales and reliability analysis, you can see that all were acceptable with the exception of the locus of control subscale. When we went back and looked at this items, we thought, maybe this isn't really measuring what we're trying to measure here. And after much discussion among the researchers here, we actually deleted that subscale from the final instrument. Lastly, the very last step of this was we sent this to two additional researchers, had nothing to do with this process, just as a final check. Did we do something silly? Is there something that we missed here in terms of wording or formatting that we needed to change? And there was no additional changes made. With all of this, as you can see, the PCA, there was some items that were deleted based off of the factor, the analysis that was conducted to end in a 90-item instrument that we have. So conclusions of this was that collectively the research provided researchers with an instrument that did produce valid and reliable scores to items measuring the five extractive factors in the study. However, obviously, we need to further test this, and that is exactly the plan of my colleagues and I to use this instrument to expand. I'm now at the University of Florida. This research was conducted while I was in North Carolina, and so we have already submitted a grant, actually, to extend this research into Florida along the Atlantic Seaboard migrant stream. So we're hoping to do that to further test this as an effective way to collect data in this population. I need to note that the study was made possible by funding from East Carolina University's Research and Development Award Program. And also, I need to acknowledge Dr. Jason Brinkley, who was the biostatistician who checked my stats on this. He's in the Department of Biostatistics at East Carolina University. And also, the last presenter on here, Rachel Ward, was an MPH student that helped us with this study as well. She's not here today, but I wanted to acknowledge her work. And I have a lot of references for you that you can refer to. Okay.
No time for questions. We can take a couple of questions if you'd like.
Yes.
I work in RTP with a company. We work with the Delta branch of NIEHS. And we've done a bunch of studies with farm workers of various kinds.
Oh, great. Right. It's 90, right. And we found that, and of course we're going to continue to test this, that the best way to do it was almost a one-on-one interview to make sure that, you know, they understand. So, yeah, no, 90 items is a lot. So that's a good comment. So in terms of, you mean, what are our plans maybe for paring down the scale in the future or attempt to do that? Right, and as we continue to test the instrument, we might see that the subscale, you know, becomes less and less and less. But as of now, with the data that we have, it showed that those items all played a role in measuring the constructs that we were measuring at the time. So they weren't deleted because of that. We're at the very beginning, right? Right. Right. And then one of the other things, actually, in working with this population that I have thought about along with my colleagues in the back is that is survey data collection techniques appropriate for this population? We saw, obviously, very rich data with the qualitative. Maybe survey data collection techniques isn't the best way to get data from migrant seasonal farm workers. However, that's what we want to find out. That's what we're trying to assess. Salon had a comment. Oh, right. So, taking the subscales, the pieces out, since there's five subscales, and using them as one, right? Well, the coping behavior piece, you absolutely could do that with this scale.
Believe me, I'm very, the notion of using standardized questionnaires for all different populations, it doesn't make sense to me. But of course, again, you're dealing with, agencies. That,
right.
Needs to be, a bias to do things with a standardized questionnaire.
Right.
More qualitative. So you have to kind of go with that.
Right. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Do we have
one more question?
I'm sorry?
Do we have key findings?
Yeah, in terms of, that's a really good question. Because of the sample size being so small, we didn't use the data to do any type of hypothesis testing or reporting even. Really what we were looking for was to validate that the instrument was measuring the constructs that we were hoping that they would measure, with the next steps to be to use the instrument to come up with key findings. I mean, we can tell you for the small, 60 that we talked to, some of the coping behaviors that they utilized, but that's not generalizable to all populations. And because of the small sample, we did not feel that it was appropriate to analyze it in terms of hypothesis testing at this time. So, yeah. Oh, thanks.